Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. My guest today says the future of American cities in this century depends on good, reliable mass transit. And he has traveled across the United States and around the world looking at the good and bad of transit, from bus to light rail and subways. His travelogue and little history of mass transit is titled Strap Hanger, Saving Our Cities and Ourselves from the Automobile. Terrace Gresko is a travel writer and author of several books on travel, including The Devil's Picnic and Bottom Feeders. In Strap Hanger, Gresko visits American and international cities where transit works well. Think New York, Portland, and Copenhagen. Not so well, but improving, Los Angeles and Philadelphia. And where it doesn't work well at all, places like Phoenix, built on the American car. And he looks at a variety of systems, from high-speed intercity rail, new subways, state-of-the-art streetcars and light rail, to bus systems that transcend our current stereotypes and perceptions. Gresko looks at cities across Europe and Asia that use transit extremely well, and how their new ideas can help change a century of car-centric planning in America. Terrace Gresko is our guest today. Terrace Gresko, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
That's great to be here, Rich.
This book, Strap Hanger, is, well, it's really a history of mass transit in many ways through a variety of cities, from New York and Los Angeles and Phoenix to Paris, Copenhagen, your own home of Montreal, Portland, and Vancouver. In each chapter, you tell us a little bit about the history and how mass transit has evolved over the years. Because, as you write, you feel like this is just the sheer weight of oil prices, of congestion in many American cities, means that mass transit has to be a part of our future, especially in North America, where it is so abysmal in many parts of the country.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, Strap Hanger is a kind of tour. It's a travelogue. It's not just a history. I kind of went out to all these different places and rode the rails where I could. In places where I couldn't, I rode bicycles or hopped on the subway in Moscow. It's true that gas prices seem to be going ever upwards, and I think that North America does need to invest in its in mass transit. The United States in particular used to be a nation built around passenger rail. It had the most extensive, massive system up until about the 1920s, but it's gradually sort of lost ground there. So in the book, I go to Europe and Japan as well and look at their bullet trains, which are really fantastic. They're supplanting air travel in cities that are about 500 miles apart. Plane routes are disappearing in places like Germany and Spain because the high-speed rail, which goes up to 220 miles an hour, does it so much more efficiently. But there's good and bad. I mean, in the major cities of the United States, they go to Los Angeles and Philadelphia and New York. There's a legacy of transit, and it's, of course, New York has its great subway and its elevated lines. Philadelphia does, too. It's got fantastic commuter rail. So there's a lot of hope. A lot of cities, even Los Angeles, is in the process of building a subway to the sea, which will link downtown Los Angeles to Santa Monica and the Pacific Ocean.
But for many cities, Tulsa is one of them, but Phoenix is another. You look at most of the cities of the Midwest and sort of the Mountain West, we're built totally on the automobile. We have a big change ahead of us.
That's true. And I interviewed a lot of transit scholars because, frankly, when you go out to places like Phoenix, which I visited, which were built completely around the needs of the automobile, most of their population growth occurred after the Second World War, and it's all predicated on freeways. However, Phoenix does have a $1.4 billion light rail system, which serves the center and serves the university. People have criticized it because it spends a lot of time rolling past empty parking lots. There's just so much dead space in those cities. But the real hope for cities that have a lot of suburbs and are rather sprawled, in the opinion of many transit scholars, is not waiting for the cities to get dense. Because if you wait for density to increase in cities, you know, for all of these multifamily dwellings to pop up, you're going to be waiting a long time. What we have to do is think about effective transportation in the here and now. And the best example for a city like Tulsa, the most affordable one, would be buses. But buses operating in their own lanes, buses where it's fast to board, all of those ideas and all that technology is out there. I went down to Bogota in Colombia, and in 3 years, the city, which was totally it's a city of 8 million, and it was totally congested and choked with traffic. And these little mini buses, which went any which way and picked up passengers along the street. They built this bus rapid transit system, which is kind of like a subway on the street. It's very effective. You have little platforms alongside major arteries. Everyone is paid before they get on, so when the bus arrives, they just kind of shuffle on. And it moves, in some of the lines, move as many people as a big city subway does. So I think for cities like Tulsa and cities like Phoenix, a lot of people talk about commuter rail or light rail. It's very comfortable, and that's why people like it, but it's also very expensive. So there are good examples of alternatives, and I think things like bus rapid transit would be perfectly adapted to a place like Tulsa.
If I can stop for just a second and sort of move us back to a larger discussion, because you know, one of the things that critics of mass transit said, you know, we have all this infrastructure built around the car. Isn't it possible, say, you know, in this part of the country, we hear about T. Boone Pickett's talking about compressed natural gas as the fuel of choice. It's very cheap at this point. It's much cleaner burning than gasoline. Perhaps electric car technology. Why do we think that transit will be the future answer at some point rather than some alternative way of powering automobiles?
Well, for me, the electric car is wonderful, but the reality is they're very expensive. You know, you're dropping $40,000 for some of these things. And about 50% of the electricity in the United States is generated by coal. So running a fleet of electric cars on coal, if you're concerned about what's happening with the climate, as I am, then that's a disaster for the future of the climate. That's why public transit's a lot more efficient. I mean, it carries more people. Your carbon footprint is a lot lower. Compressed natural gas has, you know, although it's not at the tailpipe, it has similar problems with carbon emissions. And I'm sure we're going to see a mix of transportation in the future. There's going to be more buses. Cars are never going to disappear. They're adapted to many cities. But I think it's going to take a mix, and that's going to be things. There's a slow return to cities in most of North America, which is a big change. Young people in particular, the millennial generation, are moving back to cities. So what with the return to city centers, which are going to get denser and more walkable, rationalized transit, so more bus routes, more frequent scheduling, we're going to see a change, and I think it's already underway. It's going to be harder in cities like Tulsa and Phoenix, for sure, but I think that is the way of the future. Like I said, cars aren't ever going to disappear. There's been too huge of an investment made in the interstate freeway system, and that's going to be used. But I think particularly in the bigger cities, it's already happening. People are riding transit in record numbers just because in a lot of cases they realize it's faster and cheaper than taking a car.
Yeah, and that's one of the big questions. Can it compete with the car in a various community? In many places here in Tulsa, I'm not sure that we're there yet because of congestion, but in many big cities, the congestion is so fierce that transit sort of competes with the time element. I want to ask about one statistic that was shocking to me. You talking about demotorization in the United States. 2009, Americans bought 10 million automobiles, but scrapped 14 million. That's the first time that's happened since the Second World War. That's a very telling statistic. Has that kept up over the last couple of years, or do we have statistics that says that this is a long-term trend, or was that just in the year after the big recession?
No, it's not just the recession thing. It's vehicle miles traveled, which is sort of the total miles that Americans travel in a year. That's been going down by car. That's been going down since the mid-2000s. I think overall automobile sales are down 20% from their peak year of 2000. Auto manufacturers are really worried because young people in particular, the so-called millennial generation who were born after about 1983, aren't getting their driver's license anymore. When I was a kid, when I was growing up, about half of 16 or 17-year-olds had their driver's license. Now it's down to a third. And they're saying they're just not interested because of the cost of operating a motor vehicle, because many of them are returning to cities where they find they don't need them, and sort of the attractiveness of, I'm sure some of them are influenced by environmental things. They're thinking about, you know, the impact on the environment. So that's the big worry, and that's why I think demotorization, which happened a long time ago in Japan and Northern Europe, is a long-term trend in the United States. We'll see peaks. We'll see years where more cars are sold, but gradually, as the price of oil inevitably creeps upward, we're going to see cars becoming less and less popular. And it's a good thing that it's gradual, because we can slowly introduce better forms of transportation that serve cities and don't have such a big impact on the quality of life in cities, because let's face it, freeways through urban areas destroy neighborhoods.
And of course, if you were thinking that the savings in gasoline, because young people are not driving in this country, is going to make a difference, everybody in India and China, which you've also visited, are flocking to cars. That's going to take up any sort of lessening of demand in the United States. So the price of oil is going to continue to see really heavy pressure on the demand side.
Yeah, there's a whole bunch of reasons. I mean, the price of a gallon of gas fluctuates for so many different reasons. Increased demand is one of them. I was in China, I was in Shanghai, and the interesting thing about them is there's a big middle class emerging, and for them, owning a luxury car is a big deal. You know, at the latest car show in Shanghai, they were gold Hummers for sailors, people who have the money and want this thing, but they don't drive as much as Americans do. And Shanghai, for example, built the world's largest subway system. It's now bigger than New York's in terms of track mileage in the last 15 years. So cars there are not used for commuting so much. They're used as sort of it's conspicuous consumption. But they're still facing horrible gridlock, especially Beijing. They've got 8 orbital roads now, 8 circular roads. I think they're building another one just to deal with the existing traffic. So you're right. The price of gas is going to go up. And I think that the United States is sort of connecting the dots and looking to what they've done in Europe and Asia. And anybody who's been over there and used the transit infrastructure comes back impressed. You can't not be impressed by a 220-mile-per-hour train. And China has a vast network of them now. So we got to catch up, I think. And the cars served us well in the 20th century. We changed our cities to serve them. But in the 21st, we've got to look to new modes of transportation. And in the end, they might be better for us in our cities, I think, just because every transit trip begins and ends with a walk. So there's more of an inclination to build walkable neighborhoods. And that's pleasant for everybody, and that's great for the kids who live in cities as well.
My guest today is Terrace Gresko, a travel writer. His new book is titled Strap Hanger, Saving Our Cities and Ourselves from the Automobile. It's a travelogue. It's also sort of a history of mass transit. Each city he visits, in New York, he talks about the origins of the subway system and then how Robert Moses began switching that focus from mass transit to automobile. The story of Los Angeles does the same, and how they had a great transit system. And of course, it was usurped by the automobile, and how they're trying to reclaim that. And he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Before we talk about intercity travel in transit, let's talk about city to city. You've talked a lot about the 220-mile-an-hour train, you know, and we've talked about rapid trains in the stimulus when the Obama administration first came in.
Right.
How you know, I could see how it could work on the East Coast and maybe places in the Midwest, but you're never going to take a 200-mile-an-hour train from New York to Los Angeles when you can fly there at 2/3 less time. And the infrastructure of our rail system is totally based on freight. I mean, at this point...
It is now, yeah.
Yeah. You'd have to see a major sea change in how that operates.
Well, of course, Amtrak has announced some pretty ambitious plans. They were talking about $150 billion. It's probably to go to future rail improvements. That's probably pie in the sky. But what we're seeing already is things like the Acela. There's a huge demand for it. That goes from Boston all the way down to Washington, D.C. It's getting more and more popular. Amtrak is setting record ridership numbers in the 31 million a year, which is fantastic. I don't think anybody ever thought that Los Angeles and New York, that we'd be linked coast to coast by rail. We live on a big continent. The same will never happen in Canada. There won't be, you know, overnight trips between Vancouver and Montreal, for example. But there are corridors that you can concentrate on. 70% of the population lives within 50 miles of the coast, of either coast in the United States. And the Midwest is about as densely populated as Spain, which has built its own fantastic high-speed rail network. People in Europe, even though they have this high-speed rail network, rarely do very long trips by rail. They will fly. It's for the you know, it really works well in the 500-mile range. Although I recall watching North by Northwest the other day, and it was a fantastic train that went from New York to Chicago.
Yeah, uh-huh.
There are sleeper cars there, and Cary Grant meets Eva Marie Saint in one of the more glamorous rail scenes you'll ever see. The United States used to have one of the most fantastic passenger rail networks in the world, and now it's largely been supplanted by freight. The United States moves a lot more freight than Europe does by train. I'd like to see the rail network returning, and that would serve places like Tulsa very well. As I understand it, you can't take passenger rail in Tulsa. You have to take a bus right to a nearby city. And I think there should be a rail stop in Tulsa. That should be an alternative that's available to people in Oklahoma.
Yeah, well, that's something our delegation has been working on for a while, but it just doesn't seem like the numbers are in our favor at this point. And so anyway, we've talked a little bit about city-to-city travel. Let's talk about inner-city travel. You mentioned earlier that you said buses, and you mentioned Bogota. How do they do buses where, and you write in the chapter that, you know, when we think of a city bus, we think, it may have been one of your sources who said, we think of the bus as a sort of, it's the loser, you know.
The loser cruiser.
Yeah, the loser cruiser is what he said. You know, it's if you took the bus, if you just couldn't afford any other way to get to where you needed to go, they've utterly transformed that image to one where people want to take the bus.
Definitely. And they want to take it because it's faster and cheaper than anything else. Even if you have a car, if you take the bus in Bogota, you're going to get there faster because they have their own lanes. They have prepayment. They have these subway-like platforms on the street where sliding doors on the buses and on the platform slide aside, and people just walk out like it was an elevator and then walk in like they're boarding. So they can have five buses approaching one of these platforms at once and loading and unloading about 20 seconds each. Some of the buses are articulated. Some of them are bi-articulated. They run some of the longest buses in the world. The key difference between Bogota and a lot of North American cities is that public transportation already had the advantage. Only about 20% of people own cars in Bogota, and it was mostly the rich. So it wasn't in a democratic setting like Bogota, when the mayor was elected, it wasn't hard for him to be elected on this platform of I'm going to unclog a paralyzed city. Interestingly enough, some American cities like Los Angeles have similar demographics now. Los Angeles is, 50% Latin American and African American and Asian American, and these are demographics that are more interested in transit in general. And that's why they can get the money. They passed a half-cent regional sales tax. That's going to fund this multi-dozens of billions of dollars subway to the sea. So you have to look at each city in context. But I return to the fact that cities that were built around freeways, like Tulsa, or whose growth occurred around freeways, can be served by transit. And what you do is you bring in good, comfortable buses. You make the scheduling frequent. You make the service reliable. And gradually, people will be attracted. The buses might run empty early on. But when there's a sporting event, for example, when people have to get downtown, there are tricks you can do, like lower the price that day. And if people experience reliable, fast, clean transit, they'll come back. And that's what a lot of cities have discovered.
And also, you've mentioned a number of tricks that, when we think of buses, we think of a bus that's in a lane in traffic. You set up special lanes, or maybe you designate at certain times. I know in Kansas City, at certain times, this lane is set aside for buses. And if you move into that lane and a bus comes up behind you, that's an automatic ticket. Others have, when you approach a red light, the bus triggers the light turning green, so the bus doesn't have to stop all the time. So there's all sorts of tricks involved in this, right?
Yeah, and when you're on a bus and you've paid, a couple of bucks for your fare or even less, and you're sailing past jammed up traffic while you're reading your book or texting or, reading a tab, reading something on an iPad, you start to say to yourself, well, this was really the smart choice. And I'm getting there a lot more relaxed. Car ownership is a big burden on a lot of families. The average family in the United States owns 1.9 cars. And the outlay for that, including tickets and gas and insurance, tends to be about $17,000 a year. Transit riders spend a tenth of that getting around. And you can do a lot with the money that's left over. So the idea that, you know, every functional family member will eventually have a car, I think that's falling by the wayside. But when transit improves, you know, people might find themselves turning to it and not thinking that they're riding on a loser cruiser, as people used to say.
In the United States, I guess you would have to say New York has one of the best transit systems. But who you mentioned Portland on the West Coast. These are cities that do transit extraordinarily well.
Yeah, that's right. One of the things that they do, you mentioned Portland and New York, both those cities have a payroll tax. So companies who have an interest in getting their workers to work on time pay a certain tax, if they're of a certain size, larger companies. And that's a great system because it ensures a constant flow of money to transportation. In other places, too often, they rely on the gas tax, which is unreliable because as driving goes down, you get less money. So a lot of it comes down to funding. Some interesting things I saw in other cities, London and Stockholm, do a congestion charge. They restrict cars from coming into the downtowns at certain times of day. And if you do come down, you have to pay this congestion charge. I think it's about £8 in the UK, in London. But the money that goes from that goes to fund better transportation. And in London, they've seen a fantastic increase in bus ridership on those great double-decker buses, and also bicycling. Because the streets are less crowded, suddenly it becomes safer, more desirable to ride a bike. They've even introduced one of these sort of bike share schemes, the Boris bikes, named after their mayor. There are a lot of different ideas for funding transit out there. Private transit's kind of an interesting issue because it rarely works. You really need very high densities, like in Japan, for example, where they have a lot of private commuter rail lines. It almost always needs a bit of subsidy from one level of government or the other. But cars do too. The freeway system, of course, is one of the biggest public works projects in the history of the world. And it requires tens of billions of dollars a year just for upkeep. So we have to look at it that way. Do we pour our money into the freeway system, which has all kinds of negative externalities, like, you know, carbon emissions, other forms of pollution, it encourages sprawl, or do we look at things that actually are less polluting and encourage more walkable cities like transit?
You know, a big sort of truism of American cities as they've grown and sprawled has been, you know, the idea of creating suburbs and you move out until you can afford a house. In your book, you write of many of those outermost suburbs really suffering, and a lot of that has to do with, I suppose, you know, the big mortgage debacle and just the recession. But do you think some of that is due to the fact that they are so far out and it's uneconomical to live there?
It's definitely putting a strain on outer suburbs. I went in Phoenix. I looked at what they call the Ring of Death, the very outermost suburbs that were built. You know, we're being built around 2008, and they're in big trouble. Every street you go up has, you know, bank-owned foreclosure signs. Most of them are for rent now, or for sale very, very cheap. And I talk to people in those rings, and they say that gas is a huge burden. In sprawled cities, they were driving, you know, sometimes 90, 100 miles a day just to run their errands or get to work. And that adds up with gas, you know, at the time it was $4 a gallon. It is a problem. Some scholars look at the outer suburbs and say that they are completely a product of glut of cheap fuel, of cheap gasoline, and that's going to change. We'll see what happens with the outer suburbs. I mean, already some interesting things are happening where malls, empty big box stores are being turned into libraries, are being repurposed. Some of these suburbs can be served by better bus lines that will connect them to the center or other suburbs. But in the long run, I'm not too confident about their future. I think that there's the last census showed that there's a huge return to central cities. There's a book that just came out called The Great Inversion, and it deals with just that fact that for many years people were fleeing the central cities for a variety of reasons. They wanted more square footage. They wanted more space. It was cheap. It was because of the way mortgage interest is deductible, it was cheaper than renting often. But for the first time since the Second World War, we're seeing this return to central cities. And there's a lot of potential in those central cities because there are great neighborhoods of bungalows, especially in the areas that were served by streetcars in the old days, that are still affordable. It depends on which city you're in, of course.
Yeah.
But I think that's where the future is. And a lot of the neighborhoods that seemed to be the most thriving, where families were going, were these older sort of just pre-war neighborhoods, no matter where you were, in Philadelphia or Portland, Seattle, that kind of thing.
Well, one of the interesting things you write in the book is even though you feel like North America really needs to start developing its transit systems, it has to be smart about the way it does it. For every transit-oriented development area, or TOD zone, mm-hmm. where you see a great development, you see boondoggles as well. It's very important for a community to be smart about how they build their transit systems.
Yeah, definitely. It is a huge challenge. I saw some good examples. I'll tell you about one bad example I saw. It was in Portland. It was called Orenco Station. It was built on the MAX line, which is the Portland's light rail system, which connects this suburb to the downtown. The funny thing about this place is it kind of looked, it was built with row houses. It was supposed to be sort of a Boston Back Bay type neighborhood, but it's in this pine forest, 20 or 30 miles outside of Oregon. And they built a walkable neighborhood. But the problem is, I rode the MAX line there. Very few people use transit there. Almost all of them continue to drive cars because the big employer for almost everybody in that subdivision, and it is a subdivision, although it looks kind of like a streetcar suburb in an old city, everyone works at Intel, the Intel factory. And there's no transit to the Intel factory, so you got to drive. So you have to, there are a lot of good intentions out there, but you really have to be, before you invest, you have to be smart. You have to know where people want to go. And for the time being, a lot of people want to go or have to go to office parks to work, which is why I think that it's all well and good to invest a lot of money in glamorous multi-billion dollar rail, but that can be, in the words of a lot of people, a boondoggle. What you really need to be doing is building systems that work, and often that's the bad old unglamorous loser cruiser, the bus. But you can make buses nice, you can make them fast, and you can make them frequently scheduled. And I'm all in favor of the bus. I tell you, when I started writing Strap Hanger, it's like, that's the last thing I want to be doing. The slowest things on the road, they're always tied up in traffic. But I had my eyes open to, traveling to places like Bogota, where it really works well.
All right. The name of the book is Strap Hanger. Terrace Gresko, thanks very much for joining us.
Yeah, a real pleasure, Rich.
Terrace Gresko speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. His book is titled Strap Hanger, Saving Our Cities and Ourselves from the Automobile. It's published by Times Books. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.